Hello, I'm Alex, your non-binary host, and this is the 56th episode of The Art of Asymmetrical Warfare. Today I'll talk about Northern Ireland during the Irish Civil War. As some of you may know, if you follow me on TikTok, I'm currently receiving treatment for an existing condition, which is why this episode was delayed. It's nothing life-threatening, but I had to take time off from work. I'm currently working with insurance to apply for short-term disability, but I will not be paid until it is approved. It would be a tremendous help if you joined my Patreon, Art of Asymmetrical Warfare, right now, as that is the only source of income I have at the moment. If you don't like Patreon, you can donate to my Ko-Fi, Pepper the Phoenix, and I have a Venmo as well, Pepper the Phoenix. Every little bit helps. And now that the betting for money part is over, it's time for Making History. So lots of news for Making History, partially because this is so delayed. But we're going to start with some good news. First, money bond has been officially abolished in Illinois. If you remember, I think it was either last year or the year before, the people voted, they wanted to abolish money bond, and then the Republicans in Illinois tried to take it to their courts to squash it, but now it has officially been abolished with the full implementation of the Pretrial Fairness Act. So it's a huge, huge victory. This is amazing. Some ways you can, celebrate this is by sending a letter to your legislatures that supported the act, letting them know that, you really appreciate what they've done and that you support them. You can also make a donation to help build care kits for people being released, including hygiene kits, bus passes, grocery gift cards, and more. And I will provide a link to where you can donate in the description, and be sure to follow Chai Bond Fund and End Money Bond on social media to share all the news and every other article and post that they have going on. So even though money bond has been abolished, the Chicago Community Bond Fund is still very busy. They have helped the people who had money bond before the act implemented. This was going to be a period of transition, and I don't quite know what's supposed to happen with those who had been sentenced bond before the act went into place. We'll probably still be paying old bonds throughout the end of the year, and then hopefully there'll be, according to the act, there'll be no more bonds. So Chicago Community Bond Fund still needs donations to help pay for those bonds. They're also going to be monitoring the implementation of the Pretrial Fairness Act with their partners, Coalition to End Money Bond and Illinois Network for Pretrial Justice. So we're going to make sure that, it's officially been implemented. We're going to make sure that it's implemented in the way it's supposed to be and that it's actually helping people. So there may be some follow-ups from that monitoring. And then they're going to need post-release support because they still have to work with community members who, like I said, either have to pay old bonds or are still going through the justice system. And so they still need donations. So if you can, please donate to the Chicago Community Bond Fund. I will put a link in the description of where you can donate. So kind of changing gears a little bit, now it's time for abortion. There will be a Stop Fake Clinics, a pro-abortion picket line here in Chicago on Thursday, September 28th at 5 o'clock. So basically what's happening is that there's going to be an anti-abortion fundraiser being hosted by the Union Lead Club of Chicago. And this fundraiser is specifically for Aid for Women, a network of anti-abortion, quote-unquote, crisis pregnancy centers in Chicago. And so a bunch of people are going to go out, and we're just going to protest the fundraiser. So it's outside at the Union Lead Club of Chicago, 5 o'clock, September 28th. There's also a Facebook event that you can register if you want to. So I will provide a link where you can RSVP and where you can find more information. Then we're going to switch over to book bans. For the People, a leftist library project, have a couple events coming up. So the first one is on October 5th. There's a How They Did It seminar where For the People will be talking with patrons of the Hennepin County Library Patrons Union and the Louisiana Citizens Against Censorship groups, talking to them about how they organized themselves, how they built power, and how they're resisting book bans. For the People's Library, they're also looking for data collection volunteers. So they're trying to create a huge database of all of the library boards in the entire country. And so they still need volunteers to do that. right now they have about, they've covered about 6,000 out of the 9,000 public library systems. So they have 3,000 public library systems left, and they need more volunteers. So I will provide a link where you can sign up. Basically, you can just do as little as like 5 systems to as much as like 100, and you're just researching, trying to figure out, okay, is this an appointed library board position? Is this an electoral library board position? When are the appointment dates, or when are the electoral dates? And like, basically, how does that all work? So then people can choose to run for those seats. Finally, for the people, they are looking for library board candidates. So basically, if you are interested in running for a library board position during the January 1st, 2024 to March 15th, 2025 election period, sign up. And for the people, will teach you how to campaign. They'll teach you how to fundraise. They'll basically help you throughout your entire campaign. So I will also provide a link to their application where you can sign up for that. And then finally, there's a newsletter called Literary Activism, which I like highly recommend that you subscribe to. It's hosted by Book Riot, and they do a great summary of all of the shitty things that have been happening in regards to censorship and book bans. But this newsletter that I got this morning had a really cool section where they highlighted youth groups that are fighting book bans. And so please, if you're in these areas, find these groups, give them support, ask how you can help. If you're not in these areas, still find these groups, or, you know, contact your friends in those areas. Just support them as much as you can. So the first group is the Cobb Community Care Coalition in Cobb County, Georgia. There's DALO, Diversity Awareness Youth Literacy Organization in Beaufort. There's 3 chapters. Charleston, there's 1 chapter. And then Columbia, South Carolina. There is the Intellectual Freedom Teen Council, IFTC, hosted by the Brooklyn Public Library, but open to teens 13 to 19 anywhere in the U.S. So for that specific group, if you have a teenager who's interested in fighting book bans, that's a group for you. Also, Brooklyn Public Library is amazing because they are also giving library cards to anyone in the country. So, awesome people. Students Protecting Education in New York and South Carolina. And then the Yorkville High School group, they don't have a name yet, but they're in Yorkville, Illinois. They're in basically the suburbs of Chicago. They will begin their initiatives on Monday, September 25th to address the Yorkville School Board. So they probably need a lot of help. So if you're in that area, reach out to them, see how you can help. And I know I said finally, but this is actually finally. We're doing transition to trans issues and trans rights. So right now, the Transformations Project, which does a great newsletter that I recommend you subscribe to, it provides actions, and then it provides a bunch of wins for the trans community, as well as a bunch of like threats. So right now, they are looking for volunteers. They have a sign-up sheet on their website, which I will provide in the description. They also have a couple of actions coming up for next week, and they recommend that you look at their link tree, and I will highlight them as we get closer to those events. But the really big ask right now is from their partner, the National Center for Transgender Equality, NCTE. Right now, Republicans are in the midst of appropriation bills, and they don't want to avoid a shutdown, but, like, supposedly when you're in government, you want to avoid a shutdown. And they're trying to add key provisions to deny trans healthcare. From veterans, for trans adults, to training doctors, like, they just want to defund all efforts to support trans people. So what we need to do is that we need to contact our representatives and just tell them, like, hey, don't support any line item that is going to defund trans care and trans health. And then you can also join the Global Pride campaign, hashtag trans people are loved, and just, you know, amplify a message of love and support for the transgender community. But really, the most important thing, I think, is calling our representatives and being like, trans people are worth shutting the government down for, right? Like, this isn't a soft issue. This isn't a issue that you don't sacrifice trans people just so you can have a bill and you can go home and, like, feel like you did something. You need to fight for trans people. So after all of that, we are now going to talk about a equally depressing topic, Northern Ireland during the Irish Civil War. The treaty not only tore the future Irish Free State in two, but also poured gasoline on the raging sectarian and colonial violence in Northern Ireland. Because of British colonialism, the 6 counties that made up Northern Ireland were unionist and Protestant strongholds, where a minority held power because of wealth, land, and imperial might, and the majority of Catholics were discriminated against. There was a long history of religious and sectarian violence between the two communities, with no winners and everyone ending up being a loser one way or another. And there was definitely violence on both sides. But we also have to keep in mind that the Protestant community came with Oliver Cromwell and all of that. And so there is an inherent violence and prejudice on the side of the colonizers. The provisional government in Ireland was trying to prevent a civil war. The Northern Ireland government was preparing for the continuation of one. Part 1. 1920 Government of Ireland Act. The 1920 Government of Ireland Act formally partitioned Ireland, creating the state that is now known as Northern Ireland with its own parliament. The Republicans in the rest of Ireland did not recognize partition or the concept of Northern Ireland as its own state. Similarly, the Unionists of Northern Ireland hated the idea of a united Ireland outside of the British Empire and saw the rest of Ireland as a treacherous, bat-stabbing enemy. In 1920, the British Empire still wanted to keep all of Ireland in its empire, even if both sides didn't like each other. The Government of Ireland Act created Northern Ireland with its own devolved government, but Britain refused to transfer powers until the rest of the island set up its own government, i.e., the rest of Ireland, who is currently run by the IRA and the Dáil. So until Britain reached peace with the IRA and Sinn Féin, Northern Ireland couldn't properly govern. This means that within the first year of its existence, the British government still controlled 88% of Northern Ireland's revenue and 60% of its expenditures. Only Westminster could levy income taxes and customs. It was an embarrassing disaster. Samuel Watt, permanent secretary to the Northern Ministry of Home Affairs, wrote that delaying the transfer of powers and services would mean that, quote, the whole of the Northern government will prove to be a farce and that the Northern Parliament will be nothing more than a debating society, as it will not have the power to legislate on or discuss any matter arising out of the services to be transferred. End quote is from Cormac Moore's book, Birth of a Border. One would think this would make Northern Ireland eager for a settlement with the rest of Ireland. Instead, it only frustrated James Craig, Northern Ireland's prime minister, and made him even more determined to resist all attempts at unification. When the Irish War of Independence ended with a negotiation between Britain and Sinn Féin, Craig refused to take part in the negotiations, refused to compromise on Northern Ireland's existence as a unionist Protestant British state, and refused to even consider joining an all-Ireland council. He deeply distrusted Lloyd George and saw potential betrayal behind every gesture and attempt at communication. The Anglo-Irish Treaty was signed in December 1921 and included a clause to establish a boundary commission at some point in the future. Despite the fact that a civil war would be fought over the oath, the boundary commission was maybe one of the most damaging terms in the treaty. The clause didn't include any information on when and how the commission would be created, who would be involved, how it would be established, and how the results of the commission would be implemented. It was vague enough to be interpreted a million different ways, which is the way Lloyd George preferred it. It allowed him to have his cake and eat it too. With a commission, he could promise the Republicans a future where Ireland could be unified, and he could promise the Unionists that the commission would most likely only formalize the already existing border. For the Republicans, i.e. the IRA and Sinn Féin, it was the great promise that would return all of Ireland to them. Many Republicans truly believed that only British interference kept the island split, and once Britain left and the people of Northern Ireland voted, they would vote for unification. At the very least, there was a strong expectation that the commission would return Tyrone, Fermanagh, and part of Armagh, Derry, and its western hinterlands, and down to the Irish Free State. Craig, however, was furious that Lloyd George agreed to anything that could potentially threaten Northern Ireland's borders, claiming that there was, quote, no precedent in the history of the British Empire for taking away territory from an established government without its sanction. Quote is from Cormac Moore's book, Birth of a Border. 2 years later, Craig would tell Churchill, quote, the Boundary Commission has been at the root of all evil. If you picture loyalists on the borderland being asked by us to hang on with their teeth for the safety of the province, you can also picture their unspoken cry to us, quote, if we sacrifice our lives and our property for the sake of the province, are you going to assent to a commission which may subsequently, by a stroke of the pen, take away the very area you now ask us to defend? Quote is from Cormac Moore's book, Birth of a Nation. The Boundary Commission would not meet until 1924. The treaty formalized partition by creating two dominion states in Ireland. Both sides had vested interests in appearing to work together peacefully in public while undermining each other's cause and encouraging the evacuation of quote-unquote unwanted peoples privately and often violently. Part 1A, the security situation in Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland had been preparing for a war, first to resist home rule and then to resist unification, since 1913, when Edward Carson and James Craig created the Ulster Volunteer Force, the UVF. Consequently, the Irish Volunteer Force was created by Éowyn MacNeill and Balmer Hobson to counter the UVF, and the volunteers would be taken over by the IRB, who would then launch Easter Rising, who then, you know, kind of placed Collins and De Valera and Mulcahy and Braga and Markievicz and everyone else on their course for the Irish War of Independence. So, you know, UVF was responsible for a lot of problems in Ireland. The UVF was demobilized in 1919 and Ulster relied on British soldiers to protect them from the handful of IRA units in Northern Ireland who fought the UVF and targeted prominent Protestants, while Unionists still targeted Catholics. However, given the increased violence and presence of IRA units in Ulster, the UVF was resurrected in 1920. They were mostly small groups of paramilitaries, still reliant on the Royal Irish Constabulary, the RIC, for protection, even though they didn't really trust the RIC because they believed that they were mostly Catholics, which wasn't true in Belfast in particular, but it's kind of like the prejudice, right, of like, well, they're mostly quote-unquote native Irish, they're Catholics, so they won't protect us. They were known to target, the UVF were known to target Catholics and often burnt Catholic homes. During the Irish War of Independence, Northern Ireland suffered 550 people killed. About 300 of those dead were Catholics, with 170 being Protestants and 80 being security forces. In Belfast alone, 460 people were killed and over 1,100 people were wounded. Catholics suffered over 70% of the deaths in Belfast, and it is estimated that, quote, in Belfast, between 8,700 and 11,000 Catholics had been driven out of their jobs, the 23,000 Catholics had been forced out of their homes, and that about 500 Catholic-owned businesses had been destroyed. Quote is from Cormac Moore's book, Birth of a Border. Craig was dissatisfied with the UVF's effectiveness against the IRA, and so he created the British Finance 30,000-manned Ulster Special Constabulary, the USC, to protect Northern Ireland. The USC was broken into three categories, A, B, and C, and included part-time volunteer B specials who were infamous for being trigger-happy and reactionary. By early 1922, one in six Protestant men were involved with the Ulster Special Constabulary. They also folded the existing vigilante groups under government control, issuing a communication in November 1921, quote, owing to the number of reports which have been received as to the growth of the unauthorized Loyalist Defense Forces, the government have under consideration the desirability of obtaining the services of the best elements of these organizations. They have decided that the scheme most likely to meet the situation would be to enter all who volunteer and are considered suitable into Class C and to form them into regular military units. Quote is from Cormac Moore's book, Birth of a Border. Since this was issued during the truce, it technically broke it, pissed off Collins, and embarrassed the British. The Northern government rescinded the communication, but they continued to recruit vigilantes into the security forces anyway. By the time the British transferred security to the Northern Irish government, quote, the force at the disposal of the authorities included about 2,500 RIC, over 4,000 A constabulary, nearly 20,000 B constabulary, and C constabulary now being raised. Quote is from Cormac Moore's book, Birth of a Border. However, this didn't stop the violence at all. From January to March 1922, at least 60 people, Catholic and Protestant, had been murdered in Northern Ireland. The Northern government responded by signing the Special Powers Act, enabling the government to take, quote, all steps as may be necessary for preserving the peace and maintaining order. Quote is from Dermaid Ferriter's book, Between Two Hells. The act allowed, quote, for the death penalty, flogging, arrest without warrant, and the prohibition of inquests. It allowed the Minister of Home Affairs, Dawson Bates, to, quote, make further regulations, each with the force of a new law, without consulting Parliament, and to delegate his powers to any policeman. One Unionist MP summed up the bill as, quote, the Home Secretary shall have the power to do whatever he likes or let someone else do whatever he likes for him. And both quotes are from Cormac Moore's book, Birth of a Border. The Manchester Guardian wrote, quote, whilst envenomed police politicians in the Ulster Parliament are voting themselves power to use torture and capital punishment freely against citizens whom they forbid to defend themselves while they scarcely attempt to protect them from massacre, some of their own partisans in Belfast carry wholesale murder to refinements of barbarity hardly suppressed in the Turkish attacks on Armenians in Constantinople. Joseph Devlin, a spokesperson for the Catholic minority, said, if Catholics have no revolvers, they are murdered. If they have revolvers, they are flogged and sentenced to death. And both quotes are from Cormac Moore's book, Birth of a Border. Given his state's difficult birth, Cred's administration was obsessed with protecting Northern Ireland. His party was able to steamroll all of its initiatives because Sinn Féin MPs refused to sit in Stormont, allowing the Unionists to assert control over the six counties. The administration was extremely distrustful of Catholics and refused to have them involved in the government, with an exception here and there. They paid lip service once Collins and Britton both complained that the USC was, like, overwhelmingly Protestant, but, like, no Catholic was going to join the USC. They believed that the Catholics made up a fifth column and couldn't be trusted because they were always actively trying to undermine the Unionist cause. In reality, most Catholics were simply trying to survive. Cred's administration was incredibly reactive to anything that could jeopardize their border, so when Fermanagh and Tyrone counties pledged allegiance to the Dáil and promised to refuse to recognize partition and Ulster's jurisdiction, they freaked out. They suspended both councils and stationed police in their headquarters, impounding all their records. Tyrone conceded to Ulster's power, but Fermanagh remained recalcitrant. Fermanagh's council would remain suspended for a year. The suspensions would continue to include the councils in Newry, Armagh, Strabane, Quitstown, Downpatrick, Matherwell, and Keady by April 1922. Further freaked out by this, the Cred administration abolished proportional representation elections, forcing councils to pledge an oath to the crown, and gerrymandered regions to, quote, reduce radically the number of local councils held by nationalists. You know, the classic Republican playbook if you're from the United States. So really quick, proportional representation, what that allows you to do is that, like, in the U.S., we just vote one party or the other, right? Like, we vote Biden or we vote Trump. Or hopefully you didn't vote Trump, but you know what I mean. With proportional representation, you can actually, depending on how they do it, there are a couple ways to do it, but basically you can vote for your top candidate, and then you can be like, well, if that candidate doesn't make it, then transfer my vote to the second candidate and then this third candidate. And there are a lot of ways you can do that. But it can allow smaller parties to gain larger seats in your parliament or your Congress, because basically you're just transferring votes around depending on the results. So it's like rank order choosing, basically, which really freaked Cred out, because if you have areas like Tyrone and Fermanagh where there are majority Catholics, of course their votes are going to go to the Catholic parties, and then you have this whole issue where, like, the Catholics will outnumber you in Stormont, and there's going to be a crisis, right? That's, like, the Unionists' great nightmare. As we can see in modern Northern Ireland today, because Sinn Féin won the elections, and the Unionists are refusing to create a government with them because they're scared. But back to Northern Ireland in the 1920s. Collins complained to Churchill, rightfully arguing that abolishing PR would take away Catholic and nationalist rights to shape elections in any meaningful way and trap counties like Tyrone and Fermanagh in Northern Ireland. Lloyd George's administration refused royal assent until Cred and his cabinet refused to resign. Britain did what it always did and caved to Ulster pressure and gave royal assent to ending proportional representation on September 11, 1922. Cred explained that it was important to abolish proportional representation by claiming that it, quote, submerges and clouds the issue. At election times, the people do not really understand what danger may result if they make a mistake when it comes to third, fourth, fifth, or sixth preferences. By an actual mistake, they might wake up to find Northern Ireland is in the perilous position of being submerged in a Dublin parliament. What I hold is, if the Ulster people are ever going, and I pray they may not, into a Dublin parliament, they should understand that they are voting a Dublin parliament and not be led by any trick of a complicated electoral system such as proportional representation. End quote is from Cormac Moore's book, Birth of a Border. I think a lot can be said about his, like, people make a mistake when they vote for Catholic parties or Republican parties, right? There's a lot there that we won't get into right now. Part 2B, the IRA in Northern Ireland. The IRA in Northern Ireland had been busy as well. Before the truce, there were about 2,157 men in Northern Ireland, and this rose to 4,000 by October 1921. The IRA in Dublin sent men like Emmett Dalton, Ernie O'Malley, and Dan Breen north to help train the new IRA recruits. However, the northern units still suffered from lack of weapons. By 1921, the weapons owned by the IRA in Belfast, Atrim, and East Down combined consisted of just 92 rifles, 170 shotguns, 41 automatic pistols, 186 revolvers, and 5 Thompson submachine guns. By contrast, the 1st Southern Division in Cork had 870 rifles, 3,950 shotguns, 381 automatic pistols, 1,076 revolvers, and 10 Thompsons. Quote is from Cormac Moore's book, Birth of a Border. Violence dampened during the truce, but flared up in December and increased after the treaty was signed. One Northern IRA member claimed that, quote, the treaty was a tragedy when it came, we all knew that. We knew in the North we had been left out. Quote is from Cormac Moore's book, Birth of a Border. For the Northern IRA members, the treaty was a complex matter. They felt betrayed, and yet the Boundary Commission gave them hope that they could take back Tyrone and Fermanagh, at least, and if they continued a violent campaign, they could convince the remaining counties to unite with the rest of Ireland. They were annoyed that the IRA in Dublin were more concerned with the oath than partition, but they were also willing to work with whatever side was going to help unite Ireland. Éowyn O'Duffy went north and promised the Sun and Moon if the Northern IRA remained loyal to the provisional government. Collins also promised to protect the North and became the quote-unquote unofficial leader of the Northern Catholic minority. Quote is from Cormac Moore's book, Birth of a Border. A botched escape attempt from Derry Jail by IRA prisoners in December 1921 led to increased violence and the arrest of several members of the IRA. Collins convinced Craig to release the newly arrested men and also created the Ulster Council, a shadowy new body meant to coordinate IRA activity in Northern Ireland. He, Éowyn O'Duffy, and Richard Mulcahy approved several different raids and actions along the border, including the kidnapping of 40 loyalists in the counties of Tyrone and Fermanagh, while publicly denying any knowledge of such actions. Part 2. The Craig Collins Pacts. In January 1922, the British brought Collins and Craig together to discuss the deteriorating situation in Northern Ireland. It went well, and it ended with Collins promising to end the Belfast boycott that had been implemented during the Irish War of Independence, and Craig promised to help formerly expelled Catholic shipyard workers return to their jobs. Collins ended the boycott, but Craig was less successful in helping the shipyard workers. During the same meeting, Craig refused to participate in an all-Ireland parliament, claiming that, quote, it was out of the question, possibly in years to come, 10, 20, or 50 years, Ulster might be tempted to join the South. They also agreed to settle the boundary issues together with or without British interference and via representatives reporting to Collins and Craig. The pact was broken shortly after because of increased violence. Collins had postponed the planned kidnappings to give the pact a chance, but then went through with it on February 7th to 8th. Craig was furious, blaming Collins and the British government, claiming if they had, quote, shown courage and prescience, this could never have occurred. I place the responsibility on their shoulders for having demobilized the special constabulary in consequence of the truce. End quote is from Cormac Moore's book, Birth of a Border. The Northern government asked for permission to cross the border to find the kidnapped loyalists while also increasing security along the border. The British sent arms and wireless communications. Of course, this increased violence, and in February, the Weaver Street bombing occurred. Someone threw a grenade at a group of Catholic children playing. The grenade killed 2 and wounded 4. Craig called the attack terrible, but also pointed out that Belfast had been filled with tension and violence since the kidnapping of the Loyalists. He claimed that the increased violence was, quote, a direct effort of the IRA to stir up trouble and make our parliament impotent. Churchill resisted Craig's request to cross the border with his own troops, but also pressured the provisional government to do something. The British released more IRA prisoners without Northern Ireland's permission, and Collins released some of the kidnapped Loyalists. A border commission was established, one of the many peacekeeping efforts, but it faded out of existence by April 1922. One of the most brutal incidents of violence with the Met was the MacMahon murders on March 24th. After the IRA killed two specials, a group of masked men broke into Owen MacMahon's, a Catholic, house and shot all of the men in the house, six in total. Only the 12-year-old son survived by and pretending to be dead. The IRA threw a bomb into the home of a Protestant in retaliation, and the provisional government considered breaking the treaty and invading the North. Mulcahy blamed the British for funding and supporting the specials, quote, a sectarian police force engaged in a very extensive campaign of murder and violence, end quote, is from Cormac Moore's book, Birth of a Border. Collins and Craig met again after the terrible assassination of the MacMahons and signed the Second Craig-Collins Pact, which promised to reform the Belfast Constabulary and recruit more Catholic officers. Once the IRA ceased their activities in Northern Ireland, the Craig administration would extend reforms to the other counties. Aid and assistance were also promised to Catholic shipyard workers, and both sides agreed to release prisoners. The pact quickly fell apart, and in some ways, it's questionable whether Collins or Craig ever meant to follow through on their promises. For Collins, the pact was a useful smokescreen while the IRA planned for a northern offensive. For Craig, it satisfied the British demand that he and the provisional government do something to address the violence. The British were growing weary of the Northern Ireland headache. They were supplying the northern government with vast sums of money to pay for the specials. It was estimated by May 1922 that the British had supplied the northern government with 23,000 rifles, 15,000 bayonets, 242 guns, 50 Victor guns, 3,000 RIC revolvers, camping equipment, 150 bicycles, 10 million rounds of ammunition, mill bombs for barrack defense, and motor transports. The northern government wanted air support, and Churchill shut down that request hard, replying, "It is not the business of the Ulster police to have an air force." Quote is by Cormac Moore, Birth of a Border. Part 3. IRA Northern Ireland Campaign. While it is easy and really tempting to blame Craig for his paranoia and stubbornness, we cannot ignore that Collins was never sincere in his tolerance of the Northern Parliament, and the entire time he was negotiating pacts with Craig and assuring Britain that he would use the tools provided by the treaty to settle the boundary issues, he, Mulcahy, Lynch, and several other IRA men, both pro and anti-treaty, were planning a Northern offensive. As we've discussed in other episodes, the Anglo-Irish Treaty split Sinn Féin and the IRA asunder, most members coalescing either on the anti-treaty side or the pro-treaty side. There was a brief flirtation with a neutral IRA, and it would come back in like the early 1923, but it never really went anywhere. However, there was a third group of IRA members who were angry about the treaty, but didn't understand why it should lead to a splitting of the IRA. These were the IRA units of Northern Ireland. They thought the most important clause in the treaty was the formal recognition of partition, not the oath. They really didn't care. They were more concerned that Northern Ireland would exist as a separate state. The Northern IRA units reached out to both sides, willing to work with whoever would support their efforts to destabilize Ulster. To Collins and Lynch, who were looking for a way to avoid a civil war, this was a godsend. Both sides truly believed that a northern offensive would unite the splitting IRA and prevent a civil war. This misplaced belief culminated in the Northern Offensive of May 1922. It included pro- and anti-treaty troops from all over the island, with the provisional government supplying weapons. They did this by supplying anti-treaty IRA weapons to the northern units, and British-supplied weapons to the anti-treaty IRA units. The same forces the provisional government would be fighting in less than a month. The anti-treaty IRA provided leadership, and the Northern IRA units provided the manpower. The plan was a full-out invasion of Northern Ireland. Something that, like, the IRA had never done before. Like, the closest idea to this type, the scale of operation would be like Easter Rising, which did not go according to plan. So, you know, this wasn't going to go according to plan either. The weapons didn't always arrive in the north, which hurt trust, and then the planned offensive was too ambitious for the actual forces on the ground. It consisted of several coordinated attacks along both sides of the border, with the goal of stretching out enemy forces. It required great discipline and communication, something which none of the IRA forces involved had. The attack was scheduled for May 2nd, but then called off and rescheduled for May 5th, and then postponed again for May 19th. The problem was that the 2nd Northern IRA unit, based in Donegal, couldn't cancel their attack, and so they were the only unit allowed to continue the offensive on the 2nd. They targeted police barracks at Ballida, Draperstown, and Coles Island, but achieved little. The lack of progress increased tensions between the anti-treaty and pro-treaty IRA forces, and they shot at each other on May 4th, resulting in the death of 4 pro-treaty soldiers. Collins' support of the attack waned, and he ordered the 3 Free State units, the 1st, 5th, and Midland units, to stay put, don't take part in the offensive. And Frank Atkin, on the anti-treaty side, canceled his part of the assault as well. Again, the units that got screwed over were the Northern Ireland units. The IRA's 3rd Northern Division went ahead with an attack on May 18th, captured the Musgrave Street Barracks in Belfast for a few hours before being driven off by British soldiers. The 3rd Division continued widespread acts throughout Belfast, but they were quickly outnumbered by the British soldiers. Many gave up their arms and fled. The final attack was at the Pettigrew-Villeat Salient on the Donegal-Fermanagh border, where the IRA held off for a week against the specials. The British had to intervene with artillery to dislodge the IRA. This prompted the Free Irish State to state, quote, that a policy of peaceful obstruction should be adopted towards the British government, and that no troops from the 26 counties, either official or attached to the anti-treaty executive, should be permitted to invade the 6 county area. End quote is from Cormac Moore's book, Birth of a Border. Some historians, including Mulcahy's own biographer, Pádraig Ócoim, have theorized that Mulcahy's support of a Northern Ireland offensive specifically was more cynical than Collins's support. Collins seemed to support it because it was something to do about Northern Ireland, and it would keep the IRA united and avoid civil war. I think O'Duffy was similar. But some historians have theorized that by offering a northern invasion to the anti-treaty side, Mulcahy was really distracting them, while he consolidated the National Army's forces and bought time for the reveal of Collins's constitution, which was supposed to magically heal the rift within Irish society. It did not, because of the British, and we'll get into that in our next episode. Whether this is true or not, whether Mulcahy was really thinking that far ahead, or again, he was just kind of doing what Collins told him to do, or he was like, yeah, sure, let's go invade, let's just not have a civil war, because he was also, you know, doing a lot of crisis management with the many different anti-treaty IRA units at this time, and he may have also just been, like, overwhelmed, right? Whether it's true that he was doing this as some plan to, like, consolidate his forces and to disperse the anti-treaty IRA forces, it's unclear, but what is clear is that no one really cared about protecting the Catholic minority, except maybe for the Northern IRA units. By early 1922, Northern Ireland was a tool to use for political means and for national unity means. Either way, no matter what the initial impulse or a reason for the offensive was, the result was the same for the Northern IRA units and the Catholics. They were on their own and left to the mercy of Craig and the Unionists. Part 4, Abandonment. Reprisals followed the assault, one of the biggest casualties being MP W.J. Twaddle, assassinated on his way to his outfitter's shop. I think this is like the first assassination of an MP in Northern Ireland until the 1970s. I want to say the 70s, where another MP was assassinated. After Twaddle's death, the Northern government arrested 500 Sinn Féin, quote-unquote Sinn Féin sympathizers, 300 of whom would be interned in the Argenta ship in Belfast Lough, and then Larne Bay. Most of the people arrested weren't IRA members or activists. Instead, many IRA members fled south. Some joined the anti-treaty IRA side, some just went home, and others kind of waited until they could return. By 1924, the number of IRA members in the North was a mere 600. However, those who remained continued to fight during the next few decades. It has been claimed, and was often claimed at the time, that Collins alone, amongst the leadership of Sinn Féin, had come to accept the reality of partition and strove to do something to undermine it. Quote is from Cormac Moore's book, Birth of a Border. The British, for their part, saw Collins as a representative and protector of the Northern Catholics and tried to use him to control the violence in Belfast and beyond. It is unclear how dedicated Collins truly was to the Northern cause or whether Northern Ireland was just one more card to play to avert civil war. Whatever his feelings, his rhetoric and the rhetoric of the provisional government during his administration gave false hope to Northern Catholics who hoped to join the Irish Free State and to the Northern IRA units who still believed partition could be avoided through violence. When Collins died, the provisional government gave up all pretenses of fighting to retain Northern Ireland. They stopped sanctioning IRA attacks, formally recognized Northern Ireland, and focused on their own civil war and state-building challenges. They did this, however, at the expense of the Catholics of Ulster and the Northern IRA units, who felt betrayed and abandoned. Thank you for listening to this episode. Also want to acknowledge that this episode is maybe one of the most difficult ones I've written and one I was most nervous about because it's such a hot topic, especially right now with like Brexit and the Sinn Féin victory and all that. So I hope you enjoyed this episode. I hope I dealt with it with the proper amount of like respect. Any way you look at it, it's a tragedy and there's no side that is guiltless and there's no side that was the winner. You know, I hope for a bright future for Northern Ireland and Ireland, and I hope that they find a way to work together. Whether it leads to unification or not, doesn't, you know, either way, I hope that they find a way beyond this really painful part of their history. Yeah, so I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, please, you can listen to my full catalog at Spotify, iTunes, Amazon, on my website, www.samswarroom.com. I will not feel bad if you leave a bad review because of this episode. Totally fine. Also, please join my Patreon. All of your support, it really helps, especially right now because I'm going through a bit of a health crisis or health scare, and I still want to keep making episodes. So join my Patreon to keep me off the streets and to help me continue my treatment. Until next time, wear a mask, organize your community, and stay safe.